from the National Public Radio Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the IBM Corporation, RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company, and the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's 4 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to 91 FM, WUHY in Philadelphia. And we feature Jazz Revisited every Tuesday at this time. Tomorrow afternoon at 3:30, Ken Tucker hosts Hearing Secret Harmonies, a rock music review. Thursdays at 3:30, Francis Davis hosts Interval, a review of new jazz releases. But this Thursday, Interval will be on a half hour earlier at 3 o'clock. From 3:30 until 5 o'clock, we'll be presenting a special jazz concert and workshop with jazz cellist David Aegis and saxophonist Byron Lancaster. They'll be playing duets, talking about their approach to composition and improvisation. And this all will be happening live between 3:30 and 5 o'clock, Thursday afternoon on Fresh Air. Well, tonight, the group Sphere makes its Philadelphia debut at the Afro-American Museum. Sphere was the middle name of pianist and composer Thelonious Monk. An important part of Sphere's repertoire is Monk tunes. Their new album features their interpretation of six Monk tunes. The band includes tenor saxophonist Charlie Rouse, who played with Monk from 59 to 70, drummer Ben Riley, who was with Monk from 64 to 68, bass player Buster Williams, and pianist Kenny Barron. In a moment, we'll be joined by Kenny Barron, and we hope that Charlie Rouse will be showing up and being with us later this afternoon. The Sphere concert tonight will be at the Afro-American Museum, and if you'd like to go, it's at 7th and Ray Streets in Philadelphia. There'll be two sets, one at 8 and one at 10. For any more information, you can call the museum at 574-0380. That's 574-0380. Before we meet Kenny Barron, let's listen to a selection from the new Sphere record. And this is their interpretation of Monk's 4-in-1. Thank you. 4-in-1, a Thelonious Monk composition played by the new group Sphere, which will make its Philadelphia premiere tonight in Philadelphia at the Afro-American Museum on Arch and 7th Streets in Philadelphia with sets at 8 and 10 o'clock. And with me is the pianist with the band Sphere, Kenny Barron, and he's played pretty regularly over the last few years with two members of the band, bass player Buster Williams and drummer Ben Riley. Grew up here in Philadelphia with his brother Bill Barron, who also became a jazz musician, and he's played as a sideman with Dizzy Gillespie, Yusef Lateef, Freddie Hubbard, and with Ron Carter. He currently teaches at Rutgers University. He lives in New York. In addition to the album Sphere, he has two recent albums, a solo record on Xanadu called Kenny Barron at the Piano, and an album on Muse Records called The Golden Lotus. Kenny Barron, welcome to Fresh Air. Oh,
thank you very much.
What was the reason for forming the group Sphere? How did the group get together?
Well, Buster and Ben, as you had mentioned, and myself had been playing together for quite a while, and we wanted to try adding another voice to the group, and Ben had suggested using Rouse. You know, we all loved Rouse's music. So we had a weekend gig in New York, so we decided to use him just to see what it would feel like, and it felt very good. So we decided to work towards having a permanent group, and we already had several Monk compositions in our repertoire. So we thought it would be a perfect opportunity for all of us, number one, to learn more of his compositions, and also not to pay tribute, but just to kind of play his music, because it wasn't being played, and one of the things we definitely wanted to do was to play many of the compositions that weren't being played very often. You know, so we wanted to play some of his lesser known compositions, and also we didn't want to be, a group that played Monk exclusively. So I really want to clear that up. So we do other material. But, all of this came about while Monk was still living and before he even took ill. And we kind of wanted to do the recording so that he would get a chance to hear it and hope maybe it would inspire him in some way to come back out and play. But as fate would have it, that didn't happen. But the reason behind the group was simply to play good music, and we wanted to expose people to some of Monk's other compositions, besides Round Midnight and Well You Need.
You emphasize that the purpose of the band isn't to pay tribute to Monk, but to play his music and others as well. Do you have to emphasize that because people assume that you are there to pay tribute?
And especially since the group is called Sphere, which, ironically enough, when I thought of the name, it had nothing to do with Thelonious Monk's name. I was really thinking about geometric shapes, you know, which would kind of say what the group was about, you know. And I had come up with all kinds of things, circle and some other, you know, other shapes and things like that, spiral and things like that. And finally I came up with Sphere. And the reason is simply to say that, you know, the music we want to play just kind of encompasses, or we would like for it to kind of encompass everything, you know. So that's the reason for Sphere.
Even before Monk's death, he'd been basically out of the music world or out of the visible music world for quite a while. Do you know why that was?
I really don't know. I wish I did know, you know, but yeah. He just kind of dropped out, so to speak.
Monk is certainly a legend amongst music listeners. How is he talked about amongst musicians?
Oh, the same way, with the same kind of reverence, if not more, you know, reverence and respect and love. You know, he was an amazing musician.
Everyone who's reviewed your album has pointed out that you as the pianist in the group, do not take the role as the surrogate Monk. You play in your own style with some, you know, references to Monk within it, but it's your playing. You're not there to be the Monk imitator. How did you think about what your role should be in the group Sphere, knowing that so much of the repertoire was going to be Monk's music?
Well, one of the things I definitely did not want to do was to sit down and try and imitate Thelonious Monk, because I'm a different person, so, you know. I think it would be very ludicrous for me to even try to do that, you know, because there was only one Thelonious Monk. And I think it adds another dimension, maybe a fresher approach or different approach to playing his music, you know, because... you know, again, if I tried to play like him, I think that would be the worst thing in the world for me to do.
The day that you recorded the record was the day that Monk died.
That's true, yeah.
What did it feel like when you found that out? How did you find that out?
Well, ironically, now he died at 8 o'clock in the morning, and our session was scheduled for 10. And we didn't know until after the session was over. You know, we had finished, and I had taken Buster, because his studio was in New Jersey. I had taken Buster back to New York, and after dropping him off, I happened to turn on the radio, and that's when I first heard it, and I was really shocked, you know, and surprised. And I'm sure that had we known before the session, we probably wouldn't have been able to do it.
Why not? You mean do it on that day?
Yeah, on that day. Yeah, I'm fairly certain it would not have happened on that day.
Do you think if Monk was living and if you played the record for him that it would have inspired him to come out and play again? Isn't that what you had hoped would
happen?
That's
what we had hoped, but you know, it's hard to say, you know, but I would like to think that perhaps it would have.
Is it hard to play Monk tunes without hearing his recordings of it in your head?
I guess in a certain sense it is, because, you know, you always hear that version, because his music was so personal. You know, his writing and his playing were both very, very personal. And when he played one of his pieces, I mean, it seemed like the definitive way to play it. Like, there was really no other way to play it, you know. So, yes, it's very difficult to play his music and try and get away from that particular sound. It's very hard.
How would you explain to someone who was new to his music what is happening rhythmically and harmonically in Monk that was such a kind of dramatic departure from what other people had been doing?
Well, I guess there are several things that made his music unique. I guess one of the things would be that... first of all, is his touch. Monk was a very percussive player. The way he played his lines when he improvised, it wasn't smooth. It was like very jagged and angular, you know. He was always full of surprise, you know, the way he voiced his chords using dissonance and sparseness. You know, those were like several of his trademarks. And humor was another very, very important part of his playing and his writing. And his writing, or maybe I should say his playing, was really just an extension of his writing. They were alike, his writing and his playing. And there was, you know, for me anyway, you know, virtually no difference. You know, he played the same way that he wrote.
What I'd like to do is play something from one of your records, a solo record that was recently issued on Xanadu. And not coincidentally, I guess, we're going to hear you playing one of Monk's pieces called Rhythmining. Could you explain a little bit what, if you could put into words what you were thinking about when you approached your recording of this piece?
I don't know. That's a very difficult question to answer. I don't suppose I was really trying to prove anything or anything like that. from what I understand, no one has ever played that particular piece as a solo. As you know, no other pianist has ever played it as a solo. So that was just something I wanted to try. You know, it's something just very recently I've really gotten interested in playing solo piano. So, you know, I'm trying different things and seeing how they work. You know, I think I did another one on there, Mysterioso also. You know, but his music, I think, kind of lends itself to that. It lends itself to that approach.
Well, let's hear it. This is Kenny Barron from his album Kenny Barron at the Piano, playing Rhythmining.
Thank you.
Kenny Barron playing Thelonious Monk's Rhythmining from the album Kenny Barron at the Piano on Xanadu Records. Do you enjoy solo playing?
I do, very much. I find it quite a challenge. You know, and I enjoy it a lot.
Do you ever... I've heard from some solo players that the fear about playing solo is that if there's a moment where you don't know what to do next, there's no rhythm section that's going to comp for you while you figure it out. You're on your own.
That's quite true. That's quite true. So I very seldom get nervous, but whenever I play solo, my palms usually sweat, you know, because there is that fear.
At what point in your life did you know that you wanted to be a musician?
I don't know. For me, there was never really any question.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I started studying when I was six years old, and it just never occurred to me that, you know, there was anything else to do. You know, so it was just kind of a foregone conclusion for me that I was going to be a musician.
Was that because you were good or because you loved it a lot?
Well, because I loved it, you know, not necessarily because I was good, because I loved it, you know, and... I, you know, and by the time I got into high school, I had really made no preparations to do anything else, you know, in terms of, you know, courses of study and things of that nature. So it was very definitely going to be music.
You grew up here in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
When you tried to imagine what your life as an adult would be as a musician, who did you think about? Which people were your models about what life was like?
You're talking about musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you didn't do that. Maybe you didn't what it would
really
be like that.
No, as far as other musicians, you know, I had influences on my playing. But in terms of, you know, lifestyle, I hadn't even considered that.
Your brother, Bill Barron, is a musician.
Yes.
Did you start playing at about the same time?
Well, he's 17 years older than me.
Oh. I guess not then.
No, so he's quite a bit older than me. Matter of fact, my very first gig was here in Philly with a band that he was playing with. So I was, I think, 14 or 15. You know, and it was at a dance, you know, and he was with, he was playing in the band also. So that, he must have been in his late, if I was 15, he was about 30.
Did he give you any encouragement or discouragement?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He very definitely did. As a matter of fact, it was he who got me the gig, you know, and I began working with this band. You know. And it was kind of good for me because they were all older, you know, and I was, you know, so they, I learned a lot. I learned, you know, tunes and things of that nature. So it was a very good experience for me.
Did you, like, try to find your own style, or did that happen naturally?
Well, such as it is, I think it happened naturally. But I don't think anybody is without influences, and I certainly had mine. I think when I first started playing, I was really a Horace Silver freak, and I tried to play exactly like Horace. And then one day in junior high school, I had an art class, and the instructor used to let students bring in recordings to paint by and so forth and so on. And a friend of mine brought in a Sonny Rollins recording called, I think it was Sonny Rollins, called Collector's Items. I don't know if it's Sonny Rollins or Miles Davis. But anyway, there was a tune on there called In Your Own Sweet Way by Dave Brubeck. And the pianist on that particular album was Tommy Flanagan. And that was it for me. You know, I mean, he just knocked me out. His touch, his articulation, the way, you know, evenness in his lines, voicings, everything. So I would have to say that Tommy has been, between Tommy and Hank Jones, they've been like my biggest influences.
What was it like the first time you met Tommy Flanagan?
Oh, it was, well, it was kind of awestruck, you know. We, I guess about 4 years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we did an album together. For Japanese companies, you know, just the two of us, no rhythm section or anything. And I don't think I'd been quite that nervous in a long time, you know. And it was, I learned a lot just from doing that.
You've been teaching for the last few years at Rutgers University,
mm-hmm.
Teaching harmony classes.
Yeah, keyboard harmony and also piano.
This is a pretty new role for jazz musicians, I think, because there are several universities now that have jazz programs, which is pretty new. Do you like teaching?
Yeah, I do. I enjoy it quite a bit. I guess one of the biggest rewards is really having a student who's really interested in being able to really help that student and being able to observe his improvement and development. So that's very rewarding, you know. So from that point of view, yes, I do enjoy it.
What do you think is what could a good jazz teacher do? And are there any limitations on that?
Well, yes, there are limitations. You know, I think one of the biggest things is that I can't teach anyone to play, not really, you know. So there has to be a certain innate ability that has to be there. A student has to have good ears so that they can hear things. What I can do is that I can help bring all of those things out, but I can't give those things to him, to a student. But I can help him develop those things. I can help a student develop a concept, you know, various techniques at the keyboard.
Are you ever in the position of feeling like you should tell a student that you don't think they're really very good? And
yes, I've had to do that.
Is that hard to do?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very hard to do because you don't really want to discourage people. But, you know, I also tell them that in the amount of time they have available to them as far as school, you know, that it's not possible, but they can always do it on their own. You know, but in 4 years or whatever it is, you know, sometimes it's just not, they're not going to make it.
Have you ever met anyone who didn't seem to have that kind of innate talent, but through really hard work became a terrific musician? Or does that not happen very much?
I can't say I've seen that happen. What I have seen happen is that people who didn't really have the ability, but who were very interested and who have tried hard, and I've seen them improve tremendously. I've seen them improve. I mean, they would never really make good, you know, performers, but I've seen them improve remarkably. You know, so yeah, that does happen.
Kenny Barron is my guest, a pianist now playing with the group Sphere. Do you have to grade your students?
Oh yes, I just graded papers last week. I gave an exam. You know, that's hard work.
I remember I sat in on a class that Archie Shepp was giving in State University of New York at Buffalo when I was going to school there. And just my luck, I sat in on the day when he was giving a test. And I must say I was really shocked. I thought this was a period when very few people on the university were giving tests. It was in the late 60s, and a lot of people had temporarily abandoned the idea. And I felt that day that the idea of, like, testing students on music, especially jazz, didn't seem to fit. It didn't seem to be a kind of contradictory. I don't know. I'd see it that way now.
Well, I think testing is very, very necessary, because otherwise, there's no way to really judge a student's development. You know, now. Obviously, there's got to be room for some flexibility because, in terms of playing, you know, that's difficult to judge. But there are certain things that every music student should know,
like harmony and
things of that nature. They should know how to build chords and how to voice chords and things. So those are things, you know, that I will test them on.
How will the harmony class that you teach compare to the harmony class of classical teacher would hold?
Well, I guess the biggest difference is that there are a lot less rules in my own approach, or I would say in any jazz kind of situation. There would be a lot less rules to follow. In a traditional music class, you have all these rules and regulations and to follow, you know, no parallel fifths, no, you know, no doubling thirds and things of that nature. But in my class, you know, almost everything is possible as long as it sounds right. You know, as long as it sounds right. I mean, there are guidelines that they have to follow, but, you know, all of those can be broken as well. So there are no hard and fast rules. I don't feel there should be hard and fast rules about music anyway.
Do you find for yourself that knowing the more theoretical aspects of harmony help hear things in playing, or help present opportunities in play?
Not necessarily. No, I don't think it won't help you hear things. No, it definitely won't help you. What you do, you go through a thorough, course of study in traditional music harmony. So you'll be able to do a lot of things intellectually, you know. But, the intuitive side of music, which I think is, if not more important, at least equally as important as the intellectual side of it, that side will be very lacking.
Do you listen to music emotionally or intellectually?
I like to listen to it emotionally. Because I think that's where it affects me most. You know, I know some people who are excuse me, very analytical when they listen to music. And, they dissect it. And he's doing this here and he's doing that there. You know, I like to listen to it and see how it makes me feel.
Say, I imagine like a lot of musicians, you started learning solos from records and things like that. How would you reconstruct what you'd hear? Or if you want to reconstruct for one reason or another something you've heard now, will you do it through, you know, like analyzing what the harmony is, or do you, can you just hear it and reproduce
well,
it?
Well, I can just hear it now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in most cases, you know, I can just hear it, which is the point I try and bring my students to, so that they don't have to sit down and analyze things. They can just hear it.
Right.
You know, because I think that's very important. You know, especially on the bandstand, that's terribly important.
What kind of studying did you have when you were
Well, I studied classical piano. I studied from the age of 6 till I was 16. As a matter of fact, I don't know, one of the jazz pianists from Philadelphia, Ray Bryant, I studied with his sister, who's quite an accomplished classical pianist. And I think she's in the school, teaches music in the school system here now. But I studied with her for a while. And as it turned out, across the street from where we lived, where my mother still lives in Philadelphia, lived his teacher, the teacher that he had when he was a youngster. So I studied with her also. You know, so that was my formal study. You know, just about 10 years.
Let's hear another solo recording of yours. My guest is Kenny Barron, if you're just joining us. Pianist who teaches at Rutgers University, is based in New York, and grew up in Philadelphia and is back in town tonight to perform with the group Sphere. This is a new band that includes Kenny Barron at the piano, Buster Williams on bass, Ben Riley on drums, and Charlie Rouse on tenor. And Rouse had played with Monk for about 11 years, from 59 through 1970. And this group will be making their Philadelphia premiere performance tonight at the Afro-American Museum with sets at 8 and 10 o'clock. We'll be hearing more music from the Sphere first album a little later. Right now, let's listen to something from a recent Kenny Barron album. The album's called Golden Lotus, and we'll be hearing his solo version of Darn That Dream. Would you like to say anything about this before we hear it?
It's only that it took a very long time to come out, because I think it took about 2 years after it was recorded before it came out.
Oh, for the album to come out?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's been 2 years. So, in one sense, it's old now. You know, but I still think it's a fairly good album. One of the things on some of the other selections, again talking about teaching, is one of my former students playing on there. Steve Nelson plays Vibes, who's an incredible young player.
Okay.
And so that's one of the joys of teaching.
Okay. Well, this is Kenny Barron at the piano playing Darn That Dream.
Thank you.
Kenny Barron playing Darn That Dream from a recent album called Golden Lotus on the Muse record label. Kenny Barron is in Philadelphia to perform tonight with the group Sphere, a new band comprised also of Charlie Rouse, Ben Reilly, and Buster Williams. They'll be making their Philadelphia premiere appearance tonight at the Afro-American Museum on 7th and Arch Streets with sets at 8 and 10 o'clock. And Charlie Rouse, who had hoped to be with us for this afternoon's program, won't be able to make it, and sends his regrets. Maybe some other time we'll be able to do a show together. The concert tonight, by the way, will be at 8 and 10 o'clock at the Afro-American Museum. That was a beautiful recording.
Thank you.
What made you choose that tune, Darn That Dream?
I think it's... I know why I decided to do it. On the album that Tommy Flanagan and I did together, we did that as a duo. So I thought I would like to try it alone, you know, see how it came out.
What balance do you like to keep when you're playing between standards like pop standards and bop and jazz standards?
I don't know. I don't really have a preference as such. I like to play all of it, you know. But, yeah, it should be balanced, I think, you know. So, you know, so that you don't do one thing to the exclusion of all others. But there are some good standards that I like to play. I like to find some standards that are maybe not done too often, you know, and use those. And, you know, almost anything from the bebop school I like, you know. And some of the newer things, some things that kind of go outside a little bit. I like that also, you know.
Do you find yourself listening to the radio to see what pop and... whatever is being played?
Not anymore, you know, no. I used to listen when I was living here with all musicians, all the guys I came up with. We used to anxiously await each new Miles Davis release to see what was, and usually whatever he did became the next new thing, you know. So, but I don't really do that anymore. I just listen to enjoy, you know. Unless somebody's doing something different that I particularly want to key in on, then I'll go and find that recording and listen to that, you know, to get something out of it.
Judging from your students, do you think that there's someone who they listen to, like you listen to Miles Davis, to find out what the next step is?
I don't know. There's not that kind of thing anymore. You know, there really isn't. When I was coming up, there were always bands, and there were a lot of different people who were more or less, if not innovators, innovative, you know. So you always had people to look to. That doesn't seem to happen so much anymore. When I was coming up, you know, there was Train and Miles and Ornette Coleman. So there were a lot of trailblazers during that particular period. But now there doesn't seem to be that much. I find that most of my students now are kind of going back and listening to Charlie Parker and listening to that period, you know, the bebop period. That seems to be what most of them are listening to now.
I interviewed a musician once who was playing fusion but who had, like, studied Parker in school and refer to a lot of things as bebop cliches. And he didn't, usually if I use the word cliche, I mean that it's trite and hackneyed and insignificant. But he just said that as a kind of factual thing, that this line is a bebop cliche and I'm gonna use it in my playing. It didn't seem to be a derogatory comment, mm-hmm. but maybe you have some insight into statements like that.
Well, if you listen to fusion music, you'll also find a lot of fusion cliches. But I think probably what he meant by that word is that there's a certain vocabulary that you get from you know, years of playing. He sounded like he may have been very young, though.
He was.
Yeah.
Do you ever have to, like, wean your students from trying to be an imitator of their favorite musician?
Well, not wean them, but I do caution them about it. Yeah, I do caution them about it. You know... because usually all you'll get is the surface stuff anyway in trying to imitate somebody. And at some point, you know, you do have to become yourself. You know, whatever that is, good, bad, or indifferent, you do have to become yourself. You know, and that's what's going to work for you best anyway. You know, so you can't really build your reputation or you know, your own musical style on someone else's, or, you know.
You're playing with the band Sphere now, and the band's pretty new, recorded its first record. What are the trade-offs for you between being freelance, playing with different people, or being a member of a band?
Well, each has its advantages. Being a freelance musician, which I still am more or less, because right now, as far as the band members are concerned, everybody's still very, very busy, and will be until about the end of the year. Then we'll start to really work. But each, I have been a member of other bands, so each has its advantages. So, being a freelance musician, I like, because you get a chance to play different kinds of music. You know, every band has its own particular kind of, every working band has its own particular kind of concept. So, you know, it's a question of sometimes trying to adjust to that, you know, whatever the band leader wants. And you can learn from doing that, you know. Being with a working band all the time, well, the advantages to that, too, being in a situation where you're working with a nice, tight group, you know, and players, people have been together for a long time, and you kind of anticipate each other, and it can really sound like a very cohesive kind of group. You know, so you know, each one has its advantages. I think right now, though, you know, I really enjoy doing the freelance thing, and I'm looking forward to you know, Sphere working much more.
Do you know if Sphere will be recording another record?
Oh yeah, yeah, we very definitely will.
Will it be Monktoons?
No, I think this time it will be all originals.
And your performance tonight, what will the repertoire be tonight?
It will be a mix of, you know, Monk compositions and some standards and some originals.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Pianist Kenny Barron has been my guest. He grew up in Philadelphia now, is based in New York, teaches at Rutgers University, and is currently with the band Sphere. Sphere's first record features the compositions, about six compositions, by Thelonious Monk. Two of the people in the band formerly played with Monk, Charlie Rouse, who was with Monk from 59 to 70, and Ben Raleigh, who played with him from 64 to 68. Bass player Buster Williams is also with the band, and they'll all be playing tonight at the Afro-American Museum with sets at 8 and 10, and the Afro-American Museum is on 7th and Arch Streets. For any more information about the concert, you can call them at 574-0380. Charlie Rouse had hoped to be with us earlier today for this afternoon's program. He sends his regrets, but was unable to make it for the program. Let me tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 2 o'clock. We'll hear from Yaffa Eliach, who is the author of a new book called Hasidic Tales from the Holocaust. And she teaches at Brooklyn College. Many of her students there are Hasidic. And through her students, through people that she knows from Brooklyn, she traced Hasidic Holocaust survivors all around the world, actually, and traveled to see them and to have them share with her the stories of the Holocaust that they told. Tales are very important in the Hasidic tradition, and that's why she wanted to collect these tales. At 3 o'clock, we'll hear NPR's John Merrow in conversation with Bruno Bettelheim, who has written extensively about children's psychology and about the role of fairy tales in children's development. At 3:30, hearing Secret Harmonies, Ken Tucker's Rock Review. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be talking about herpes. With me will be Frank Freudberg, the author of a new book about herpes, and it's an overview on the latest that the medical profession knows. He's interviewed many people who have herpes and people who counsel people who have herpes. Also with us will be Fran Simon, who's the founder of HELP, which is a herpes hotline. So that will be from 4 till 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, and I hope you can join us then. Dan Lachlan and Jay Goldman were the technical directors for today's show. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant, Danny Miller the associate producer. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. This is WUHY FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company, the Communications Workers of America, representing 650,000 members nationwide in telecommunications and other fields, and for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
There seems to be an emerging identity, distinctive set of values, not being overly concerned about material achievement in a commercialized world. The wealth has, by and large,